Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
You may proceed. Chief Justice Phillips is ill this morning and will not be here with us to hear the oral presentations. However, he will participate fully in the deliberation of all three causes. We want to welcome some students from the Westwood High School and Hyde Park Baptist School who are participating in the YMCA's program, Youth and Government. And we may also have some students later this morning, if they're already not here, from Shriner College in Kerrville. We have three causes on our oral submission docket. The first cause is General Motors Corporation versus Maria Science. The next case is Rosa Natividad versus Alexis and William Steen. And the third case is Rita Rodriguez versus George Rodriguez. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If counsel wish to avail themselves of that recording, you may make application with our clerk. Those of you who have been here before know that we have a timer with a red and green light that usually alerts counsel of the time remaining for their argument. The timer is not functioning. Went out last week. They don't make them anymore. But we're going to improvise. Our marshal will alert counsel of the time remaining with some cards. We're ready to proceed with the argument on the first case.
May it please the court, Mr. David Heilbronn will present argument for petitioner for 20 minutes.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you. This is the case about the warning that nobody read. The critical facts are undisputed. They're pretty jarring. GM built and sold that Bear truck cab and chassis back in 1971, worked fine for 15 years, and then a second stage manufacturer, Sascon, a commercial builder, put that 2,000-gallon water tank on that Bear cab and chassis. GM didn't know that, didn't know who Sascon was, no way it could. The water tank was way too big for the truck, and when filled, it overloaded that truck by many tons. GM set forth the maximum weight the truck could handle on a plaque. It was at eye level on the door jam. You could see it as you went in and out of the truck. It was right where federal law said it ought to be. The owner's manual warned in big capital letters, first page after the index, don't overload the truck because you can create serious potential safety hazards if you do. And the manual was in the glove compartment just where everybody knew it would be. But the second stage manufacturer, Sascon, didn't look at the plaque, didn't look at the manual, put that oversized tank on the truck, and sold it to a construction company called Cantu. Sascon did know, however, without looking at anything, that you ought not drive that truck down the highway at highway speeds with the tank full. But it didn't warn Cantu about that, didn't tell it not to fill up that tank, didn't give it any warning at all. And no one at Cantu looked at the plaque or looked at the manual either. Cantu's foreman, however, knew without looking at anything not to drive that truck down the highway with the tank filled. But contrary to the foreman's instructions and the custom in the industry and the warning that nobody read, sadly, Mr. Sienz drove the truck down the highway at highway speeds with the tank filled up and apparently a leaking tire. The tire blew, the accident happened, those are the facts. And the lawsuit is based upon the theory that the warning that GM gave and nobody read was inadequate and that unread warning caused this accident. And it sounds wrong, and it is, on two independently sufficient grounds.
Is a part of that claim that the reason the warning wasn't read was that it was inconspicuous?
Well, not really. The Court of Appeal says that its finding, what it found, by reason of the inadequacy of the information, doesn't say anything about conspicuousness. And in the closing argument, counsel actually said that the problem here is information, not conspicuousness. And, after all, this plaque was at eye level, according to federal law, where it should be. Their expert said that's an acceptable place to put it. The manual was in the glove compartment where everybody knew it would be, and as a matter of custom, it always is, and it's where Cantu would have looked if it were looking for information, and citations that I've referred to so far are at 776 and 3423 and 2424. And their expert, Wallingsford, said, typically a reference to the manual is just fine and accomplishes the purpose in the construction industry, and that's at 776. And if you don't read a manual, it doesn't matter if the letters in it are a foot high. So there really isn't a conspicuousness issue here.
If there were, that could be a basis for liability.
If there were, under Texas law, as I understand it, it could be, but the standard under which the Court of Appeal decided this case would still be wrong. I might add that everybody agrees here that the primary object of the information was the second stage builder. And the idea that there ought to be a warning other than in the glove compartment, in the manual, for a builder is a little bit preposterous. I mean, he's not sitting in the driver's seat monitoring the dashboard for information from minute to minute as you go along. He's out there building. And when he wants to look for information, the custom in the industry is that you look in the manual. And indeed, they admit that nobody puts the warning or the information anywhere inside on the cab. That's at 1786. So a guy in the business of building would not look to find information where it never is. The rule. You can't complain that a warning that no one read is not inadequate for the very good and obvious reason that since no one read it, what it said or didn't say couldn't have caused what anybody did or did not do. Or to put it a different way, changing words you don't read with other words you don't read changes nothing because words that are unread affect nothing.
That's absent a claim that the warning is inconspicuous?
Well, if the claim is that the warning were inconspicuous, and if there were facts to support it, which there aren't, that claim could be made. But again, the standard under which this case was decided by the Court of Appeal had to do with the adequacy of the words used that nobody read. Court of Appeal held that technical chemical changed that obvious common sense rule and established as a matter of law that you really have to pretend that a warning that everybody knows wasn't read was read. And with respect, the Court of Appeal just misinterpreted technical chemical on its front end and its back end. As to the front end, technical chemical holds that where there isn't any warning at all, is presumed that if there had been one, why it would have been read. And the presumption and the reason for it is this. It has its roots in a very flesh and blood problem. If there is no warning there, it's kind of hard to figure out what would have happened had there been a warning there to read. But there was a warning here to read. So the reason for the rule, the technical chemical presumption, does not apply in the first place, and accordingly, neither does the presumption. But to get down to it, it really doesn't matter whether that presumption applies or not, because even if it does, it is clearly rebuttable. Technical chemical clearly says that it is, by, for example, proof that the presumed reader is illiterate or blind or irresponsible. And GM proved that Sascon and Cantu were not just in general irresponsible, but they were in effect willfully blind. GM proved, without dispute, that no one read the warning as a matter of undisputed fact. And therefore, it rebutted the presumption as a matter of law. The Court of Appeal, however, ruled that the technical chemical presumption that the warning was read as a matter of law was not rebutted by undisputed evidence that it was not read. So the upshot is that the rule, according to the Court of Appeals, is that a rebuttable presumption that ought not apply in the first place can't be rebutted, and instead it substitutes the fiction that a warning has been read for the fact that it has not been, regardless of proof, for all time, as a matter of law.
Was the statement on the door jamb, is that essentially repeated in the owner's manual?
No, the door jamb statement, which is a plaque, sets forth what the weights are that are not supposed to be exceeded. And then it says, for further information, look at the manual, something their expert said was a fine thing to do. The manual...
Is this the total vehicle weight or the weight on top of the chassis?
It was the gross vehicle weight that could be carried on the whole truck.
Was a statement in there of what the vehicle weight was?
Well, the manual had in it a statement of what its curb weight was.
Let me ask you a question, if I may. Did indeed one of General Motors company representatives, an expert, testify that the statements on the door jams were not warnings, were not considered warnings as in the classical sense as far as danger, that they were really a warranty statement that if you violate these things, you're warranty?
Well, he said that the information on the plaque was information, which it clearly was. That's what it was intended to be. And it did clearly say that if you exceed these limits, why the warranty will be voided. But it also said, look at the manual. And in the manual, there clearly was a warning. And it clearly said, you know, you're going to create a dangerous condition if you overload.
Did another expert from General Motors, is there someplace in the record a statement from another General Motors expert advocating that warnings should be repeated in the owner's manual? That they should be like statements in the owner's manual that are on the door jamb?
I don't recall that. I do recall it having been said by both sides that the manual was an appropriate place for the information to be put, particularly bearing in mind, as you had to, that the people to whom the information was provided were pros. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
I believe so. Was one more. Was there evidence as to what additional cost might be involved if warnings were more conspicuously placed or enhanced in bold type or something of that nature?
There was evidence that it wouldn't cost, as it really never does, much money to write on paper. Of course, people have to read it. But as for the bold type, there's no doubt that this type was bold, and it was on the page after the index in the manual that nobody looked at.
Should we overrule Alam against Alcoa?
I don't think you have to. In the first place, Alm does not deal with a question of cause. What we've been talking about so far really is not presented by Alm. But Alm stands for, and I would like to get into the second ground here, concluding with the proposition that, as to the first ground, what we really have is a make-believe rule of law, not a rule of law, the presumption that a fiction is fact for all time. But as to the second count, that is, whether we had a duty to give an instruction beyond what we gave, Alm does not have to be overruled at all. Alm is one of a series of cases that stand for the proposition that in different circumstances you limit the duty to warn by what is practical. This case stands for the very same proposition, and the Elliott-Verge rule that we rely on stands for the very, very same proposition in a little bit different setting, actually quite a different setting. Because in Alm, the manufacturer knew how the product that it built was going to get to the public. It was in the form that it was designed by the manufacturer to reach the public in. Here, what's happened is that the product is changed before it reaches the public by somebody 15 years after the fact, unknown to the manufacturer, and in a way that could not possibly be known to the manufacturer. So this is an a fortiori case.
Mr. Heilbronn, I know GM takes the position that we manufacture in such a way that we don't know what they're going to do with it, but it seems to me GM knows exactly what others are going to do to it because they built the truck to be modified. So, I mean, I'm a little bit nervous about saying, well, since GM didn't know what they were going to do with it, these warnings didn't have to be given. It seems to me GM specifically designed this truck to be put out into a secondary market to be modified to carry loads. So why, I mean, I know GM says we can't give a specific warning as to each thing, but if I build a thing designed specifically to be modified by others to carry a heavy load, why wouldn't there be a big warning on the back of the cab that says whatever you're putting on the back of this thing, make sure it doesn't exceed the gross weight loading of this truck?
Well, no doubt GM builds the truck to be modified, but it's obvious that the number of modifications that can be put in this truck are infinite, limitless, said so by the dissent, really stipulated to fact. And the problem is that you simply cannot warn about every single different modification in the limitless world that can be made. Because if you did, you would have a limitless, by definition, number of warnings with the consequence that nobody would be able to read them all. And they'd look kind of like the New York Times billboard effect, as the case law puts it, with the consequence that that whole conglomeration of warnings wouldn't be read by anybody. Nobody would really know what they meant or what they applied to, and the ones that really counted would be lost in the snow. But it's really a practical problem. You cannot warn about the consequences of a modification that somebody else makes improperly, and that's really what's going on here. I mean, it's not the problem that the truck is modified to carry a water tank. The problem is that the truck is modified to carry a water tank that's way too big for the truck. And there's no way that that can be foreseen 15 years before the fact in any specific way other than by warning about that problem and every other problem in the galaxy of problems that might exist. Now, let me get back to a basic proposition, if I might. The restatement is the base. And it says that a manufacturer is not liable for defects that exist at the time the product leaves the manufacturer's hands. That's 402A. And the manufacturer's duty to warn is measured at the same time. And there wasn't anything in the world that was wrong with this truck when it left this manufacturer's hands. There's no doubt about that. Their own expert said so. That's at 1771. Sascon created the dangerous condition that existed on this truck. Defect that caused this accident when it put that water tank on it. And there isn't any doubt about that. Their own expert said that too, and they say it here. It was the addition of the tank, they say, which allowed the vehicle to become significantly overloaded when full. Well, according to the words, the plain words of the restatement, that just is not GM's nickel, and that's also the right result. For the reason that responsibility is really what's at issue. And in no real or practical sense can you say that GM, first stage manufacturer, is responsible for the consequences of a defect that somebody else creates 15 years after the fact and that it does not know about. And you cannot say that it's responsible in any real or practical sense to warn about that problem that was unknown to it, because after all, you cannot warn about what you can't know about. Sascon is the person who created the problem and in any real practical sense is responsible for it. And just a word about Elliott Verge here. They say, really, that the guy who's in the best position to warn about the consequences of the modification that he makes ought to warn about the consequences of the modification that he makes. And there just isn't any doubt how the Elliott Verge test cuts here. They say the second stage manufacturer is responsible to warn about defects that he creates where practicality and trade custom and the relative expertise of the first and second stage manufacturer show that the second stage manufacturer ought to do that. And here, as for practicality and trade custom, it's obviously impractical to warn about something that you can't know about. And there is no custom to do what is not practical. And as for relative expertise, that turns, according to Elliot Birch, on who's best acquainted with the design that creates the problem that you're talking about. And there's no doubt that that's Sascon here, because the water tank was its design, and GM had absolutely no acquaintance with it at all.
And you urge us to adopt the test that the Fifth Circuit adopted in Birch back in 1978.
Well, there's Birch, there's Elliott here in Texas, and
right.
There's...
It doesn't mention Birch, does it?
Yes, it does. Elliott actually follows Birch.
Yes, I see.
And Trevino, which right. is also a Fifth Circuit case, follows both. And they are not unique. I mean, as the case law cited in the amicus brief shows, that's the law around the country. So Texas is in accord with the law around the country. This case is not.
The test that's set out in Verge, referring to trade custom, expertise, practicality, some of the factors that come into play there are factors that are not dissimilar from the way we go about defining defect in a case in Texas. It's a different test, of course, but you weigh these factors. Why can't that same weighing process, if we adopt the test of Verge, be weighed by a jury?
Well, if you were to adopt the test of Verge, it is possible that in some cases it would be a jury question. Just doesn't happen to be in this one, because it's obvious where that three-part test takes you. Practicality, we've talked about. You can't warn about something you can't know about. There isn't any custom for a first-stage person to warn about what somebody does 15 years after the fact unknown to you. And as to acquaintance with the design, GM had none. So it's clear that as a matter of law, Elliott Verge lead to the result that GM is not responsible here. I'd like to say...
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
I simply allude to the briefs that talk about punitive damages.
The case is submitted based on oral argument and the briefs.
Yes. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Mr. Raymond Garcia and Mr. Victor Carrera will present argument for respondents. Mr. Garcia will open for 12 and a half minutes. Mr. Carrera will then continue for 12 and a half minutes.
Judge, this warning that nobody read was not considered a warning by GM's own expert, Mr. Carl Jensen. He was a corporate representative. He was the design engineer that GM brought forth to the trial of this case, and he admitted that this was not considered a warning. This was information provided on the door plate that, yes, we've got a 17-year-old vehicle. This information said if you exceed gross vehicle weight rating, and it was very confusing as to what it really said, whether 16,000, 24,000, 20,000, all it did was if you exceeded this, you would void the warranty. We've got a 17-year-old vehicle here. Nobody cared about voiding the warranty. Everybody with any common sense realized that warranty was long gone. 12 or 15 years earlier. Now, what we've got here is a case where GM's own experts, after having studied the case as long as they did, we had Mr. Carl Jensen, we had Mr. Ed Martinez, the accident reconstructionist, all our engineers, the doctors in engineering, we had Mr. Walt Reed, and we had Mr. Russell Marhefka. Every one of these gentlemen was asked by me during the trial of this case. Now, at what point do you believe that Mr. Herman Sklock, Sascon, at what point do you feel that if he constructed a water tank and placed it and assembled it on his truck, it would be overlooked? We got four different answers. Nobody could tell me specifically that if you put a 2,000-gallon, 1,000-gallon, 500-gallon tank on this truck, you would be overloaded, and therefore it would be unstable. What we've got here is a warning that is not a warning. We are challenging the conspicuousness of the warning, and also the adequacy of the warning. Now, we're not... The modification...
What do you say the warning should have said?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What do you say the warning should have said?
if you overload this vehicle, this will render the vehicle unstable and allow it to be susceptible to rolling over and causing death or serious harm.
How is that different from the owner's manual that says overloading can create serious potential safety?
Well, I didn't get through in my response. You've got to be specific, because the issue here is overloading. At what point do you overload this vehicle? You've got to be able to say, GM, the people that are in the best position to know, the ones that designed this vehicle, that made this cabin chassis, are the ones, and their engineers should know that this vehicle can only handle so many pounds that it can carry. Beyond that amount, it's going to be overloaded, and it's going to be susceptible to rolling over and causing death, as we have here. Two boys died within a year after this vehicle had this water tank placed on it. For the 15 years of its life that it was a tow truck, nothing ever happened.
Does it make a difference whether the load is 6 inches off the frame or whether the load is stacked 30 or 40 feet above the frame? That same weight would have a different effect on the truck, would it?
Not under the facts of this case, and not in this case.
In this case, if the water tank was not full, it was more stable than if it were full.
That's correct.
How can you warn against that? Don't fill it up?
Well, you warn against a particular weight limit, and then it's up to the second stage manufacturer to understand. Everybody understood it was very common knowledge to figure out how much a gallon of water weighed. If you had 1,000 gallons, you multiplied it by so many pounds, and you'd get the gross weight. That was something that was understood by even the mechanic that was involved there at the lower level at Cescon that was involved in assembling this particular water tank on this truck.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Hillbron's claim that GM said if you put a water tank on the back here, don't put in more than 1,000 gallons of water. If you put a tow mechanism back here, don't put more than a 2-ton truck on the tow. If you put a toolbox back here, don't load more than 5,000 pounds of tools. If the water tank is 5 feet high, you can put 1,500 gallons, but if it's 20 feet high, how do you respond to Ms. Hilburn's argument that if that's the type of warning you're requiring, then basically you're requiring a truck that's nothing but warnings, and so you lose the effectiveness of a warning?
We're asking General Motors, our primary manufacturers, to just give one warning. The warning, the basic warning, the one that applies to whether or not you got a beer truck, a milk truck, or any kind of water tank truck, whatever type of truck. Overloading will result if you, the gross vehicle weight rating of this vehicle is X. Beyond X, you've got an overloaded vehicle, and then it's up to the people that are, you know, the second stage manufacturers to determine what uses are going to be made of this vehicle, and the people that are ultimately using it will determine whether or not they're going to be towing a particular kind of vehicle or having a 10,000-gallon tank on its truck.
Does a fluid load react differently than a solid load? Say if you had a load of pipe or you had a load of concrete blocks, as opposed to a load of virtually any kind of fluid, water, oil, milk, the type of fluid would really be irrelevant. Do they react differently on a curve or when a vehicle swings around? Doesn't that load shift more readily?
Yes, sir.
The weight of the load through centrifugal force out more?
Yes, sir. That is a factor, that the water, I'm sure, would shift more than perhaps solid pipe. But if you still have the overloading effect and you still have that tire blowing out, you're still going to have that.
The shifting load, your overload would be less than with a solid load. Is there any type of information in the owner's manual or anywhere as to dangers that might be imposed by a particular type of load?
No, sir, there was none. There was no distinction made.
Was there any expert testimony at trial regarding the dangers of particular types of loads?
Yes, sir, there was. Mr. John Stilson testified about the distinctions between having carrying a liquid as opposed to carrying some other kind of a product. But he also stated that towards the end that he still had to need to look at the weight. And at the time that tire blew out, that driver lost control of that vehicle because of the instability.
The fluid load, it would seem to me, as a layman, would lend itself more to instability than a solid load because it shifts.
It's
more subject to centrifugal force, I would assume, or at least pushing the weight of the vehicle itself in that direction. Was there, I'll pass, I think someone else has a question.
As I take your brief, you do not quarrel with the Elliott-Byrd-Trevino test. As a matter of law, you just complain of the way petitioner argues it should be applied in this case.
Judge, we're contending that the modification did not create the hazard. We're not talking about the second stage manufacturer installing a gear truck or a pothole truck, as in one of those cases. And
my question is a little different, though. As a test, you don't quarrel with the test that those cases say should be applied. You disagree with the petitioner over how it is applied in this case.
That's correct. We feel that we're looking at trade custom. The federal government imposes a duty on the manufacturers, the primary manufacturers, to talk about gross vehicle weight rating. And their common practice, according to the testimony of Mr. Carl Jensen, is that they do provide that type of information. The relative expertise, I don't think there's any question, the primary manufacturer is in a better position to have that expertise than someone like SASCON, a second stage manufacturer, as is noted by the facts of this case. And the practicability, we had Mr. Walt Reed that testified, and he was a defense expert, that the manufacturer of the cabin chassis was in a better position to impart clear and concise information as to the hazard involved in this particular case.
Can I follow up on what I was asking a while ago regarding the fluid loads? Was there a testimony or evidence in kind that a lower weight would be required, a lower fluid weight would be required than a lower solid weight in order to avoid the danger of instability? Did the experts allude, or any of the experts allude, to a lesser weight in fluid load being mandated?
Your Honor, I don't remember, and I don't want to misrepresent it.
Was there any evidence that, if indeed this was the case, a warning should have distinguished between fluid and solid loads?
Yes, there was evidence that because we had a fluid, because we had a liquid, and because of that, the manner in which that vehicle turned as a result of that blowout, that was what led to the vehicle becoming more unstable and ultimately to the road.
It's your argument that GM provided this raw chassis that was designed to be modified for a variety of purposes. They should have at least anticipated that it might be modified for liquid loads as well as solid loads, and that their warning, if indeed this was a warning at all, totally failed to address that distinction.
That's correct. But Mr. Carl Jensen, GM's expert, admitted that it was a foreseeable use, that the use that was made in this case by SASCON was a foreseeable use.
If GM had the type of warning that you referenced on there, then they would be free of liability in this case.
Correct.
And if there was some type of warning in the owner's manual, was there not?
Yes.
If that warning was not read, how can it be said that a different warning would have been read? The basic argument GM seems to be making.
Here we go back to conspicuousness, and also the testimony of GM's own warnings expert that says that a warning of this nature has to be repeated, not just in a manual, but also in areas such as the door plate, which was not. And we go back to the fact that four people, engineers, read it, and they were not able to come back with a precise statement as to what overloading meant under the warnings or the information provided by GM in this case. Mr. Carrera would finish your argument.
May it please the court, it's certainly an honor to be here. I'm going to talk at some of the areas that were addressed by opposing counsel, and certainly the question of whether the Elliott-Byrd rule should apply is one of the things I'm going to talk about. The theory on which the plaintiffs went to trial was that there was a failure to warn under by General Motors, second stage manufacturers, and secondarily to ultimate consumers under Texas law. And it's clear that Texas law says that if a manufacturer is aware of a hazard, that it has a duty to warn. They do not dispute that. In fact, page 19 of their application, they agree that there is a duty of a manufacturer of a cabin chassis vehicle to provide warnings to a second stage manufacturer. Now, the duty is, of course, to the ultimate consumer can be discharged by proving the learned intermediary rule under ALM. GM did not try to meet the burden in this case, and there's clearly legally sufficient evidence of a failure that they failed to discharge this duty. Mr. Skloss at SASCON said, I can't warn about what I don't know. There's expert opinion testimony that GM failed to provide adequate instructions to SASCON. Conspicuousness is a big issue in this case. They're trying to say that Mr. Skloss didn't look at anything. They say his Mr. Alvarez, his foreman, the testimony of Mr. Alvarez was, I did not notice anything. And I did not know that owner's manual was in the glove box. And there's case authority that says that there is a jury is free to determine that a warning, if it is inside an owner's manual, is not conspicuous. There is the Bradshaw case, I believe, that's cited in our brief out of Corpus Christi. It's very clear that there was a duty on GM to warn and that they failed to discharge it in this case. Now, which brings us to the application of the Elliott-Berger rule. If you read the cases, those apply to a design defect and not a warnings case. You have to misinterpret the theory on which the plaintiffs proceeded in order to decide that Elliott-Berger applies in this particular case. The Third Circuit itself, which spawned the Berger rule from which Elliott was derived, has said that that does not apply if you're applying a failure to warn case to one component. In that case, there was a tank, and they were alleging that there was a failure to warn by the tank manufacturer that was placed on a chassis. And they said the Elliott-Berger rule does not apply in this case because you're not looking at the whole thing. That's the Holloway case that is cited in our brief. Now, regardless, if we are to look at the Elliott-Berger rule, the trade, custom, relative expertise, and practicality, GM did not attempt to meet that burden at trial, did not even attempt to analyze the facts in this case in their appellate brief or in their application for writ of error. If you do look at it, we've analyzed them at page 20 and 22 of our application. This would militate for imposition of the duty against General Motors. There's clearly legally sufficient evidence to that effect. The majority in this case, while questioning whether the Elliott-Berger rule applied, says, under these facts, the duty was on GM. Justice Nye, in dissent, said, under these facts, the duty's on SASCON. Clearly, that phase is a factual dispute, and that has no basis in this court. This court is without jurisdiction to overrule that decision of the majority. I will now address the technical chemical arguments that GM seems to be making. For the first time before the Supreme Court, they seem to be taking the position that for existing, quotes, warnings, close quotes, and I say that intentionally, where they're not read, however inadequate, then a presumption exists that inadequacy cannot cause the injury. And that's not what technical chemical says. What this court said in technical chemical is that the presumption is that an adequate warning would have been read. Their experts at trial said there was no warning in this case. It was just information. On appeal before this court, GM has not attacked the jury finding that the information they provided was not a legally adequate warning. As a result, they can't rely on any claimed presumption.
Would any warning in the owner's manual have been adequate in your view?
Not if it wasn't noticed, Your Honor. And there's case law that backs us up on that.
How can you give a warning to somebody who won't read it?
You can do it with a pictogram, Your Honor. There are different ways of doing it. But in this case, the primary warning, Your Honor, is from the manufacturer to the second stage manufacturer. And if the manufacturer provides a proper warning, they have complied with their duty to the ultimate user. And I think that is from the ALM decision of this court. GM did not try to meet that burden in this case. In fact, the evidence was to the contrary, that they failed to meet that burden.
Counsel, if the only information furnished is that the maximum gross weight is certain figures, that is not a warning?
That is not a warning, according to GM's own experts. And in this case, Your Honor.
But is it necessary then to always, in order to have a warning, at law to spell out consequences of violation?
That is Texas law as I understand it, Your Honor. You've got to identify the hazard and on how to avoid it.
And that it must be conspicuous.
Correct, Your Honor. It must be conspicuous.
So to have an adequate warning, you have to have more than just the fact that you cannot do a certain thing. You have to spell out the consequences, and it has to be prominently displayed.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's my understanding of the law in Texas.
I suppose that Kim would acknowledge that it's foreseeable that this chassis, which is designed for further modification by secondary manufacturers, might be utilized to accommodate a fluid load as well as solid loads. I don't suppose they would dispute that. Under the circumstances, do you think a warning, in order to be adequate, would have to warn that to warn the secondary manufacturer that the vehicle should not be equipped to accommodate a solid load, say, of 15 tons or a fluid load, assuming that there is a distinction between the two, in excess of 10 tons or words to that effect, or an elevation of not more than 10 feet from ground level or say, 7 feet from the truck bed?
As far as elevation, Your Honor, one of our allegations is that there was absolutely no information provided as to a maximum vertical center of gravity in this case, and that was one of the issues, aside from the overload.
Neither in the manual nor on the door jam?
None whatsoever, Your Honor. In fact, the evidence was that within 2 or 3 years after the manufacture of this vehicle, General Motors started to put that type of information. The question of overloading, Your Honor, as far as the effect on the vehicle itself is the same whether you have a liquid load or a solid load. In this case, it's very clear that it was overloaded on many occasions, and that had an adverse effect on the tires, which is directly related to the cause and facts of this collision. Now, there are differences in the way a vehicle handles, whether it is full or empty. Now, Mr. Heilbronn said earlier that the evidence that SAFCON gave him was that they should not travel on the vehicle with other than an empty load. That is not entirely correct as I understand the evidence. The evidence was that you either have an empty load or a fully loaded tank. That way you do not have the sloshing. And in this case, the tank was fully loaded according to the evidence, according to GM's own expert. So
it would have been even more dangerous if they'd have half-loaded it, saying, hey, we don't want to fill this up way too much, so we'll just half-load it.
As far as the stability questions, there would probably be differences in the handling characteristics if there were a half-load, because there's some sort of hammering effect.
You have a 5 minute warning.
Very well.
Could the first stage manufacturer ever satisfy your test for the duty to warn? Because in order to do so, they'd have to warn of the consequences of a particular manner in which the product has been modified by the second stage manufacturer, wouldn't it?
There are duties on the second stage manufacturer to warn about the particular changes that it makes. And that is the distinction that, you know, counsel for GM says, oh, GM should put all of these warnings and anticipate all these. We're not saying that, Your Honor. We're saying that GM should give adequate warnings on overloading, center of gravity, maximum vertical center of gravity. Those apply to all modifications of the cab and chassis vehicle. A proper warning in this case to the second stage manufacturer would have prevented the installation of a 2,000-gallon gas tank. Perhaps a 1,000-gallon gas tank would have been installed, and that is what Mr. Skloss testified to. If I had gotten that information, if I had been aware of that, I would not have installed a 2,000-gallon tank. So I hope I've answered your question.
Why? I don't understand. How would that information have changed whether it was a 2,000 or 1,000 gallon tank?
Because if you fill a 2,000 gallon tank, you've grossly overloaded the vehicle. If you fill a 1,000 gallon tank on this vehicle, it would have been right at the carrying capacity of the vehicle. In fact, there was
how would he have known that unless he was interested in how much? I guess my question is, if he was concerned about the weight of water on the back of the truck, why wouldn't he have read the warning to find out how much weight he can put on the back of the truck?
Your Honor, it's the duty of GM to make, give a conspicuous warning and to give some conspicuous information as to those weight ratings, Your Honor. In this case, Your Honor, there were three different weight ratings given on that plaque, that bronze plaque. So there certainly was not sufficient information, much less a warning that was provided.
Mr. Carrera, Judge Meyer put a lot of significance on the fact that the warning given on the plaque on the door confirmed to federal safety regulations. How do you disagree with Judge Nye in that regard, or if you do?
It conformed with the federal regulations in effect at that time, Your Honor, but you've got to understand that the federal motor vehicle safety standards are minimum standards, and there's Texas case law, Your Honor, that says that just because you conform with federal regulations, including warnings, does not mean that you cannot, that the warning or the information given is adequate under Texas law, and I think there's some pharmaceutical cases that stand for that proposition, and I believe we've cited them in our brief, Your Honor.
With regards to the warning in the owner's manual, pursuing a question just as I've asked Mr. Garcia, you believe that that warning in the manual was also inadequate?
Correct, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Jansen said that also would not be considered a warning even by him, and it gave no real consequences as to the potentials for harm and injury from overloading. And additionally, their own experts, as we've talked about, says the warning should be repeated in an owner's manual. The owner's manual is directed, I think, to the ultimate user, is not directly to the second stage manufacturer. And there's Texas case law that says that an owner's manual is can be inconspicuous and is not the proper place to put a warning.
The owner's manual also said if you have further questions about, if you're unclear about this warning, consult your dealer.
Your Honor, there was also evidence to the effect that the average GM dealer, the tank manufacturer said the average GM dealer knows about as much as my three-year-old son, you know, about loading things. That, you know, would probably be an exercise in futility.
So is giving warnings that nobody reads?
Well, Your Honor, if they're conspicuous enough, they will be read and noticed. And this court has indicated
that. You argue it should be in the cabin somewhere? Is that,
there was a warning that General Motors had placed with regard to downshifting in the cab at the time that the vehicle was marketed, and that was what we considered a location for a good, strong, conspicuous warning, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
My time has expired. I want to thank the court for the opportunity to allow me to be present.
May it please the court. Mr. David Heilbron will continue argument for petitioner for 5 minutes.
Briefly, they say there's no warning. This is a word game. We invite the court's attention to this document. Start safety caution. Now, this is a warning.
Well, did your expert say otherwise?
He did not say this is not a warning. He said there's information here. There's obviously a caution here. So did their experts agree that it was a warning.
Didn't it appear to be linked more to the warranty?
Not this. The plaque says what it's supposed to say according to federal law, says what the limits are. This is inside the manual, and it has nothing to do with a warranty. It says overloading, safety caution, and it goes on to say what it says. They say, gee, you should have given a warning as to what the exact loads were. We did say what the exact loads were. We discharged the duty that they say we should have discharged.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked counsel. been cited a while ago regarding the nature of the load. Now, as I understand it, this vehicle, this chassis is produced for secondary manufacturer modification for presumably both fluid and solid load carrying tanks or vans or what have you. Is indeed, or does the record reflect that there was testimony at trial from experts regarding the distinction between fluid loads and solid loads?
The real problem here was that this truck was overloaded, whether it were liquid, solid, or whatever else.
That doesn't answer my question. Was there evidence at trial regarding fluid and solid loads and the distinction between them?
There was evidence that this was overloaded, and it was also sloshing back and forth. The water was, but it's also clear that the problem was, according to them, it was overloaded. Their expert at 740-838, their other expert at 1562-64, counsel at 3389-3391. No question about it. The problem was it was overloaded, whether it's liquid, solid, or anything else.
Was there, I believe, counsel for the other side said that there was evidence that a 1,000-gallon load would have been adequate or appropriate, but a 2,000-gallon load was a gross overload, that the 2,000-gallon tank was placed on there by the secondary manufacturer.
Correct.
GM had properly warned and conspicuously warned that you should not put more than 1,000 gallons. It might have made a difference to the secondary manufacturer.
Well, no, Your Honor, I think he's proved the point. He's saying that 1,000 gallons would have been okay because it wouldn't have been overloaded. 2,000 gallons is not okay because it was overloaded. The warning says don't overload, and it gives the weight that you're not supposed to overload over.
It doesn't give the weight of the vehicle.
It does give the weight of the vehicle. It gives the curb weight of the vehicle in the manual.
Counsel, the counsel for the respondent tells us that under the Texas law, a warning must be explicit as to the maximum weight, that the consequences of violation of the maximum weight must be spelled out, and that this warning must be prominently displayed. Those three characteristics, do you agree?
Well, I agree that under Texas law, the warning is supposed to carry its meaning in understandable terms, and it's supposed to be reasonably able to cause somebody to understand what it's talking about. But this argument is really never land in unreality. I mean,
but
they say
the third aspect, being prominently displayed.
Well, there, that's not quite the words. It has to do with catching the attention of, I think, is what's in the test, in the Texas test.
Catching the attention of who?
Well, catching the attention of the person to whom it's directed, but the proposition...
But not necessarily to the driver.
No. The proposition... No, because as they say, primarily this is meant for the second stage manufacturer. The proposition they put here is really startling. That is, you cannot put the warning in the manual. That's what they said. No place in the manual can you put this and discharge the obligation. Now, that's amazing. The whole case is really kind of a charade. They say, gee, there was a misunderstanding as to what the exact numbers were here. Well, the misunderstanding, if there were one, was as between whether this truck could carry 16 or 20,000 pounds. The fact was that it could carry 20, so that if you made a mistake and thought it was 16, you just think that the truck was even more overloaded. The problem was that it was 26,000 pounds that the thing was carrying. Center of gravity, they talk about, there was no problem with respect to center of gravity because there was no evidence as to what the max CG was or that there was anything here that caused anything to exceed that max CG. Finally.
Counsel, your time has expired. Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
The audience, please rise.
Make a short recess.